Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the 1977 Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it, about their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we're continuing our journey through the T section of the Monster Manual. And as you can maybe hear, I've still got a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to be trying to take this one easy. Before we get started, I wanted to say a few words about the second Monster Man contest. I haven't really been promoting this with the same intensity that I promoted the first one, and that's basically because I just haven't had a lot of time over the past few weeks. As a result, I haven't had all that many entries. One person entered. So I'm going to extend the deadline. Please stand by for further announcements. We have got some prize sponsorship, which I'll talk about soon, so it is well worth your interest. But I just haven't had the free time to do it justice, so hopefully we'll be able to accomplish that over the next 2 weeks when I have even less free time, but more resolution. Alright, our first monster for this episode is the Titanothyr. Now the Titanothyr, today we would probably call this a Brontothyr. So the Brontothyridae are what used to be called Titanothyridae, as I understand it. I'm not a paleontologist. And it's, you know, it's related to rhinos and tapirs, and it's a big herbivore that has a funny thing on its nose, kind of a Y-shaped thing, although a different species had slightly different eccentrically shaped horns. The Titanothyr is fine. Somebody who worked on this sure owned a book about the wildlife of the Pleistocene, huh? Comes up an awful lot, and these kind of prehistoric megafauna are fine, but we already had the Baluchotherium, and we've had various kinds of prehistoric. And we had mammoths and mastodons, and I'm sure we've had others. And honestly, we had the woolly rhinoceros or the giant rhinoceros, and we have a generic entry for herd animals, and I just don't really see how these guys are different. It's another large, powerful, but basically not aggressive herd herbivore. Although, mechanically, it's actually quite different from the Baluchotherium, but I don't know whether I am to attribute that to actual differences between the two animals or to stat block creators making it up as they go along. So Titanothyrs are great, but I can only imagine that this is a creature motivated by somebody having a toy of it, since its primary appeal is that it's visually interesting. Next up, we have the Toad, Giant. You know something? I'm not completely sure what the difference between a frog and a toad is. Hold on for a second. Everybody, I have big news. Toads are frogs. They're the same thing. Toad is just a term for a kind of frog. Scientists don't distinguish between toads and frogs. I've been living a lie. To be 100% honest with you, the toad, giant, I mean, it's a little bit redundant with the frog, giant, isn't it? You do have the ice toad. That's quite cool. We don't think of ice toads or ice frogs. Generally, you know, cold-blooded animals, we don't associate them with cold climates. And there's something gross about toads, and doubly so about ice toads, because you imagine they'd be really clammy. I don't think I have an ice toad model, which is a shame since they're in Frostgrave, and I play Frostgrave, so I should be able to have one on hand. Like the Titanothyr and its other prehistoric herbivore relatives, the toad is mechanically quite distinct from the frog. You tell me why. It seems like they would be pretty much the same thing. The usual association is that toads are evil. When we think of, you know, witches having familiars, those include toads, and we've seen that in the other type of evil familiar spirits, like the imp and the mephit. Whichever one of them, there's one of them that can turn into a toad, I know that much. Don't think that's a toad, giant, I think it's just a toad. Anyway, giant toads are great. If I had to have giant toads or giant frogs, I would have giant toads, because toad is grosser. Sathagwa is a toad god. If he were a frog god, he wouldn't be nearly as intimidating and he wouldn't be nearly as disgusting. We envision toads as big, fat creatures sitting there just regarding us with their hideous, blinking eye. So toad, giant works really well. Frog, giant. I think frog, giant, you need the frog to be interesting in some way, so like the poisonous frog. There's a poisonous toad as well, but lots of cultures seem to think of toads as poisonous, but maybe that's because some frogs are poisonous and they're thinking of frogs, since toads, apparently, and I stress that I learned this a minute ago, are frogs. Next up, we got the Trapper. What can I say about the Trapper that I haven't already said about the Lurker above, which is a Trapper but upside down? Or the Piercer, the Roper, the Mimic, and all the other creatures that occur as natural hazards in a dungeon. I guess the Trapper is the one that's most direct about its goal, which is to say, part of the dungeon exploring experience in Dungeons & Dragons is traps. but traps only make sense in certain contexts. If you're exploring an ancient tomb where a king was buried with all his riches, it makes sense that the civilization, to protect it from grave robbers, would have built traps into it, especially since absolutely no one is supposed to be in there. In the same way, a secretive cult that might lack numbers could use traps to defend their lair, relying on the fact that, you know, the cultists know where the traps are and how to get past them, and the law would get hit by them. But a lot of dungeons are based on being caverns or some other kind of natural formation, and there, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense that there would be traps. So you wind up either with natural obstacles of some kind, the bridges out over this underground river, or just a series of monster fights. And just a series of monster fights is not terribly exciting. I think in early D&D, the idea that everything was supposed to be a series of monster fights was only just beginning to take root in the late 70s and early 80s. I think, at least if OSR types are to be believed, that more of a puzzle element existed in a lot of these dungeon challenges. So these trappy monsters are basically a way to get that trap gameplay into your game in a dungeon where it doesn't make sense for anyone to have set any actual traps. It doesn't make me like them anymore. I noticed that the regular size trapper covers a 400 square foot area, whereas the giant size trapper covers a 600 square foot area, which is not really all that much bigger. When you've got something that's only 20 feet wide, it only has to be 10 feet longer to make it 200 square feet bigger. There are some fun parts about the trapper. I'm particularly fond of the way it does damage, which is based on the armor class of the victim. So your light armored guys get crushed because the damage is 4 plus the victim's AC. And remember, of course, that we're talking about first edition AD&D, so armor class goes down. If you're very heavily armored, your armor class is 0. Conceivably, that means that you could be rolled up in a trapper getting smothered for quite a long period of time while your friends tried to figure out a way to get you out. So that's cool. And finally, we come to the real star of tonight's episode, or at least the creature from tonight's episode with the most impact on the game as it is played, the Treant. Now, obviously, Treants are originally meant to be Ents from The Lord of the Rings. In fact, in early editions of Dungeons & Dragons, maybe just in the very first, they were called Ents, but the threat of legal action, or at any rate a gentle reminder that that was a copyrighted term, prompted the change to Treants, just as Hobbits became Halflings. Here's the thing, though. The Treant ultimately developed into something very different from an Ent, or perhaps it was already very different from the Ent as it actually appears in Lord of the Rings. You know, we're accustomed to thinking of Ents as kind of giant anthropomorphic trees, but as you may know from listening to this podcast, or as you may know from a familiarity with Old English poetry, Ent is just the Old English word for giant. And although Ents do sort of herd trees, and definitely have tree-like qualities, I almost got the impression that they were meant to be quite human. That's not how subsequent generations of artists have portrayed them, of course, and I think nowadays we all pretty much think of Ents as being animate trees. Indeed, when Warhammer had to not use the word Ent, they just used the term tree man, which is not super inventive, but it's definitely accurate. They're probably called something else now. Anyway, the point is that the Treant has developed into a much more menacing creature in later editions of Dungeons & Dragons, and one that isn't necessarily the, you know, protector of the forest that's portrayed here. Here I think we see it in a transitional stage between Tolkien's Ent and the more generic kind of intelligent animated tree. The illustration in the tree ant entry is kind of curious. It shows pretty much what you'd expect, a tree ant picking up some interloper to the forest to give him a biff, but we learn from this entry that a tree ant can be up to 23 feet tall, and that even the shortest of them are about half that. So for metric listeners, that's anywhere from about 3.5 to 7 meters. But the figure picking up the guy in the illustration looks, you know, a bit taller than him, maybe 7 or 8 feet tall. So that's 2 and a bit meters. 8 feet, I guess, would be 2.5 meters, something like that. So that's kind of interesting. I wonder if the description wasn't very clear at the time that the illustration was being written, but we've seen some disconnects between the illustration and the entry previously. But tree ants are great. I mean, like Ents, tree ants come with all the emotional meaning that we already give to trees, which is an acknowledgement that they can kind of be frightening. They're old, and they're big, and we sort of think of them as knowing something that we don't. And we're conscious that we do things that hurt them. That they are the mute victims of our greed in some cases. And if you think about the story of the giving tree, I mean, the Giving Tree is meant to represent a parent's unconditional love and generosity toward their child. But perhaps like many children with their parents, we have some sense of guilt for all the things that we take away. And when we go into a really dense forest, it's very hard to shake the feeling that we are intruders, that we don't really belong. And tree ants kind of play on that. So they can be the happy defenders of the wood, but you're not in charge of them. They get to decide what means the wood needs defending, and they may make decisions about that that you don't like. Anyway, I'm sorry for the slow pace and general low tone of this episode. I'm trying to spare my voice a little bit. I hope that you enjoyed it, and I hope that you'll join me next time as we talk about the Triton, the Troglodyte, the Troll, which I've already done a special episode on, and the Turtle on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.